Welcome to Studio Tulsa on Health. I'm John Schumann, sitting in for Rich Fisher. Our federal government appears to be in a quagmire of unresolvable, closely held viewpoints. As a nation, do we design programs to give everyone, especially our children, an equal opportunity to achieve, or do we set limits on the role of government and strive for self-sufficiency and the economic independence that comes with it? At the core of the debate is the Affordable Care Act, known colloquially by both sides as Obamacare. Depending on your viewpoint, Obamacare is perhaps the apotheosis of the Great Society or the final abomination of the welfare state. Stark contrast, to be sure. Key to the passage of the Affordable Care Act was the complicity of the medical, pharmaceutical, and insurance industries. Pundits love to rail against the latter two, accusing them of making money off the backs of our sick loved ones, while single-payer systems in other countries provide basics that our nation does not equally offer. My guest today, Dr. Jack Summers, is the medical director of an insurance plan based in Oklahoma called Community Care. Right in the name, you hear a different use of language from the typical insurance plan. Community Care is offering benefit plans to Oklahomans on the state's federally run health insurance exchange. It's Dr. Summers' job to make sure the plan uses an evidence-based approach to provide its members with safe and effective, cost-conscious, and high-value care. I wanted to hear how he and Community Care are coping with the changes wrought by Obamacare and how his company is strategizing for the future. Dr. Jack Summers is my guest today in studio at Studio Tulsa on Health. Dr. Jack Summers, welcome to Studio Tulsa on Health.
Thank you very much.
I was hoping you could start by just giving me a brief history of Community Care.
Community Care has been around for since the mid-1980s. They started with a couple of local hospitals who developed a PPO type of insurance product for some kind of local input. That developed in the early 90s to develop an HMO. So they started in the 1993 developing an HMO. They picked up another couple of owners in Oklahoma City, St. Anthony and Mercy. In 1996, they added a senior health plan, Medicare Advantage type of health plan, and we just kind of grew from there. I've been with them almost since the beginning. As far as the HMO is concerned, I started with them in 1997.
And the HMOs sort of proved kind of unpopular toward the end of the Clinton administration as, I guess, people started to realize there were more restrictions on where they could go outside of the network?
That's correct. There's some people who really like to go wherever they want to. We find most of our members really like to stay within Tulsa, and we have a very good network in Tulsa. We don't find that most people really want to leave their area. They like to stay close to home to deliver care. In larger towns, you know, Chicago, where you have, you know, a huge kind of a network, that might be very different. But in Tulsa, it's a little bit different since we're homegrown. You know, we have the major hospitals contracted with us, and so they really don't really have any problems finding someone to go to.
And who are the folks primarily that Community Care serves?
Whoever wants to come to us.
Nowadays, especially, well, yeah, right?
That's correct. Even before the Affordable Care Act went active October 1st, we had an individual health plan, so individuals could sign up with Community Care. We have small employers, large employers. We have a senior health plan. For a long time, we did Sooner Care until Sooner Care dropped their managed care part of their business. So we really were in everything.
What makes Community Care innovative among health plans? Is it the locally managed part of it?
I think that really makes us very different. You know, I kind of grew up medically speaking in Tulsa. I went to medical school here. I did my residency here. I practiced here for 13 years before I became a medical director. So I know Tulsa very well. The other thing that makes us very unique is our ownership. We're owned by St. Francis and St. John's Health Systems. And I think that gives us almost an ACO type of a picture where the incentives are aligned. We're working with the physicians to really seek out the best possible care for every member that we have. So I know that in a lot of health plans, there's an adversarial relationship between the health plan and the physicians. We really try to bridge that. We try to be a resource to our physicians. We look for the best possible alternative for care for that individual patient.
So I want to take a step back. You mentioned ACO in your previous statement, and that stands for Accountable Care Organization.
Yes,
and that's something that gets thrown around a lot. And I just was hoping, from where you're sitting, could you explain in layman's terms what that is?
Sure. It's a group of providers, and providers is a medical term. It could be a physician, like a doctor. It could be a hospital. It could be a loose conglomeration of all those who are getting together to provide care for a group of patients. The Accountable Care Organization is a byproduct of the Accountable Care Act, or Affordable Care Act. I forget what they call it nowadays. We're kind of going back and forth.
Obamacare.
Yes, Obamacare. And what it was created to do in that act was to you had to have a minimum of 5,000 patients, and then you have a governance structure of this group of providers who agrees that they're going to provide care, accountable care, to those at least 5,000 patients. They're responsible for keeping track of cost. They have to meet a certain number of quality metrics. In the early pilots that have been going on, about half of the pilots have actually shown a cost savings. About another third have neither gained or lost, and a third of them have actually lost money. So you do have to be accountable for the care. You have to look at more efficient ways to deliver care. There's a lot of waste in the medical system, and the Accountable Care Organization is made to look a little bit inward at itself and saying, what are we doing that does not add value, that we're doing things that are wasteful? Are we duplicating tests? Are we doing procedures or lab work that doesn't really need to be done? There's an organization called Choosing Wisely. It's an organization put together by physicians. The American Board of Internal Medicine actually put it together. And they went to each specialty society, the family practitioners, the gastroenterologists, the lung specialists, the heart specialists, and say, give us five things that are being done too much. And they're coming out with their second edition. There's so many things that are being done too much that they're coming out with not just five, but 10 and 20 and so forth. For example, and we see this a lot when someone comes in with back pain, a knee-jerk reaction from the physicians, well, let's do an MRI. Well, that's a $2,000 test. All the evidence shows that that's not necessary. You know, 85 to 90% of that will go away within 4 to 6 weeks, regardless of what you do. So what's the point in doing the MRI unless you really need to do something? So it's a wasteful test to do at the beginning of care. And so they look at that and say, do we really need to do that test? Let's wait and let's do the physical therapy. We know that that adds value. That makes people better faster. And so by the Accountable Care Act, looking inward at what they're doing and how they're delivering care, they can save money but also improve outcomes.
We were talking about the Choosing Wisely campaign. You gave the example of back pain and over-testing. And I guess really then in summary, that's what accountable care is getting physicians or providers, it could be hospitals too, to look really critically what they're doing and saying, putting cost as more of front and center in terms of doing something that's cost-effective.
Well, I'm not sure I'd say putting it front and center, but bringing it into the equation. When we're looking at things, we don't always look at cost first. We just say, you know, is that necessary? The alternative might actually be more expensive. We're just saying, is that really necessary to do? We had a patient who, an oncologist called, and he wanted a series of CAT scans and PET scans and so forth on a patient who had refused therapy. And I said, what are we really doing if he's refusing therapy? And he just paused for me and he says, you have a point there, I guess. We're not really doing anything because it's not going to affect how we treat him. He's already refused treatment. I guess we don't need those. And, you know, sometimes doctors do things automatically, again, it's a knee-jerk reaction without really thinking about, well, is it really going to impact the person's life? Is it going to impact what we do with their care? If it's not, then don't do it.
Yeah, I mean, I wonder if the doctor was thinking, oh, if I demonstrate that the cancer has progressed on these scans, maybe then I can convince the patient to undergo therapy.
Well, we brought that up with him, and he says, no, he really is going on hospice. I mean, that's what he wanted to do. We presented him the alternatives, and he said, I don't want that. I want this.
So there's been a lot of press about the Affordable Care Act rollout. So October 1st, the healthcare exchanges went live. It's been a rocky start. So Oklahoma is one of the states that does not have a state-run exchange. We are part of healthcare.gov, which is the federally run exchange.
It's been a rocky start in those states which had a federal exchange. It has not been as rocky in those states which had a state-level exchange.
And do you think that's just due to the sheer volume of users? Is that that's
no.
sort of my no?
No, I don't. If when you talk to the users as well as the people behind the scenes, it's really probably due to a poorly designed central marketplace. The places in the states which have a lot more hands-on, you know, Kentucky, California, New York, who had very good IT development, are not having problems. It's the federal exchange is the one that's having the most problems.
So people in those states are able to get online and have been able to purchase insurance.
We had 15,000 people signed up in Kentucky in the first week. You've had 40 or 50,000 signed up in California, New York. Again, they have state-level exchanges. In Oklahoma, they can't even give us a number. They have no idea.
The data is just not available yet.
That's
not
correct.
Made available. So in community care is part of the exchange, right? I mean, you're offering individual plans under the exchange.
That's correct.
Tell me a little bit about the thinking that went into that. I mean, it's a marketplace, so you want it to be represented, and you'd already been in the individual marketplace. How big a percentage of, I guess, your business or how many individual policies did you cover or sell prior to the Affordable Care Act?
I really don't know that number. We had been in the individual market for a couple of years. The biggest thing is we saw that was the direction everything was going in. You can agree or not agree with the Accountable Care Act and the politics behind it. The issue is it's the law of the land, and if that's the law of the land, we're going to go along with it, and we're going to do as best we can with the hand that we're dealt.
So and then you were looking ahead, you were planning, and you were already in the individual market, so it certainly made sense to get involved.
That's correct.
Do you, at your back end in your office, do you know how many policies you've been able to sell or, you know, how many people have bought in, or you can't know that because the system is so broken, you can't get the data?
Well, again, the agreement with the government was that they would give us a daily feed, and we have not received a feed since the exchange opened. When we went in one day on a kind of a demo, we were just kind of playing with it. We did notice that we had two members who had signed up with us, so we know we have someone through it.
There's at least two.
But we're not getting any kind of a feed on a daily basis like we should be getting from the government.
Okay. I'm going to shift gears a little bit and ask you about something that I've become aware of called the Comprehensive Primary Care Initiative.
Love it.
Okay. Tell me more about that and what, you know, why would a patient or, in, you know, insurance language, a beneficiary care about CPCI?
Well, let me back up a little minute. The CPCI is basically created to develop a new system of care. Tom Berwick, who is the former head of CMS.
That's Medicare, right?
Yes, Medicare, right. Gave the analogy that the chassis of healthcare is broken. You can't stress the system anymore to deliver either more care or better care. He said one time that the definition of insanity was to keep doing the same thing and expecting a different outcome. We have poor outcomes in healthcare. We need to be better than what we are, and to continue to stress the current system of care is not going to help. It just makes physicians frustrated and they leave. So they started looking for a different model of care. What's a different system that would give us the triple aim? And the triple aim, according to Dr. Berwick, was better outcomes, increased patient satisfaction, and lower cost. And I don't care which side of the political aisle or philosophic spectrum you're on, it's hard to argue with those three points: better outcomes, more satisfied patients, and lower cost. In the trials and pilots that they have been done, the only thing that they could show on a consistent basis that would do that was the patient-centered medical home. And this is a different way to deliver primary care. The problem is, in delivering this type of care, it's very resource intensive in primary care. It actually increases the cost in primary care, but it decreases cost in the system because you're decreasing hospitalizations, you're decreasing visits to the emergency room and so forth. And those are higher dollar services than just a visit to your primary care physician. What Medicare decided to do in the CPCI, the Comprehensive Primary Care Initiative, was to get a group of payers together who would all pay what's called a prospective payment to physicians' offices. They would pay them a certain number of dollars every month, whether they saw the patient or not, and then when they saw the patient, they would also be paid for their care. So they get paid up front for not even seeing the patient, and then they get paid when they see the patient. This was done by Medicare because they understood that for primary care offices to develop the system of care, you needed to prime the pump. You needed to give them some money so that they could hire additional staff, they could put new infrastructure into place like new computer systems, more sophisticated computer systems that could help the doctor deliver a different kind of care. And so nationally, there was a competition, if you will, about who was going to be in the CPCI. We knew that seven regions were going to be chosen. Tulsa, Oklahoma is the smallest of the seven regions that were chosen, but Blue Cross Blue Shield, the Healthcare Authority, as well as CMS and Community Care are the four payers in Oklahoma, and we're working together. In fact, we're a model. We're being looked at other parts of the country and all the seven regions for the collaboration that we've developed here in Tulsa. We think that's highly due to some efforts with Dr. David Kendrick and MyHealth, the health information exchange that he's building, the medical information portal, if you will, that he's building. We have been collaborating on that for 2 or 3 years already. So we're used to working with Blue Cross. We're used to working with the healthcare authority. And that's really, we're friends. We share information. It's no longer a competition. It's what we like to call a co-opetition.
A co-opetition.
We know that we need to cooperate to make health better. When we make better health for the community of Tulsa, northeastern Oklahoma, it's going to help everybody, whether it's a patient, a health system, or a health plan.
I mean, it seems very enlightened. I mean, it's just refreshing to hear that you know, competitors would collaborate so collegially.
Yeah.
Well, and so I'm curious, too, if you mentioned the healthcare authority, which is really Medicaid or Sooner Care, Medicare itself, and then Blue Cross Blue Shield and Community Care, do each of the four entities pay in equally, or does it depend on the number of insureds that they have and they pay proportionally?
Yeah, that's a good question. It really depends on the person. It depends on also the severity of the illness of the patient who's being cared for. We know that if you have 8 chronic diseases, it takes a lot more resources to care for that person than it does for a healthy 20-year-old. So the dollar figure is varied by payer and by the severity of illness of the patient who's the individual patient. We've dealt with that for a long time. In our senior health plan, our Medicare Advantage program, that's the way we're paid by Medicare. So we've been used to a severity-adjusted payment. Going forward, health plans are part of the problem in that historically we've paid for widgets. We pay for a visit. And if you want care outside the visit, historically there's not really been a good way to pay for that. So trying to create a more value-based payment, you know, what are we really paying you to do? What is the doctor being paid to do? Is it for a visit or is it to keep you healthy? And then how do you set up that payment methodology? Is it a monthly payment, just a capitation? Well, that has some drawbacks. Is it just fee-for-service? That definitely has some drawbacks, and it's led us to the mess that we're in right now. So maybe let's do a blending, and that's what we've kind of come to with CPCI.
Do we have any data yet on the impact of that, or is it still too early to know?
It's still too early. Part of the problem that we're having right now is we're still not able to compile all the data into a single dashboard for each practice. We have community care data, we have Blue Cross Blue Shield data, we have healthcare authority data, and so forth, and these silos. One of the things that we're really hoping that MyHealth will give us, again, the health information exchange that Dr. Kendrick is building, is we'll be able to put all the data into one place, and then the physician can pull up information on all of his patients and really look at, you know, how many diabetics do I have in my practice? So let's really work on delivering better diabetes care, how many people with chronic lung disease, chronic kidney disease, and really work on that. The way we currently deliver care, even with the electronic medical record, most physicians don't have the capability to do that. They don't have a way to risk stratify their patients. They don't have a way to look at what is the cancer risk or the cardiovascular risk for this patient. MyHealth really gives us a very powerful dashboard to do that.
Even with the computers in healthcare, electronic medical records, we're still, it's the one patient, one visit, assessing the current need.
Very much so.
And we're trying to get out in front and look at systems or look at, you know, patients as a panel and looking at populations, yeah, or communities more.
It's one of my church we call the tyranny of the urgent. You know, when the patient comes in with an urgent problem, you take care of that urgent problem. But when you do that, many times you miss what's important behind the scenes that you don't see.
You're listening to Studio Tulsa on Health. I'm John Schumann sitting in for Rich Fisher. My guest today, Dr. Jack Summers, who's the medical director of community care, health insurance plan here in Oklahoma. And we're talking about the Affordable Care Act, among other things. And I was wondering, in your role as medical director, I heard you give a talk one time about how you evaluate care on a cost-effective basis. How do you make those decisions? Or do you do it by committee, or do you make decisions? And for example, the real question is, let's say I have community care as my insurance, I'm going to go to the doctor. How does community care decide what's going to be covered and what isn't going to be covered?
A very good question. We do it by committee, really. We have a committee called the Quality Improvement Committee. When a new technology comes out, we evaluate that as much as we can. We also have a technology assessment vendor. It's one that's very well established. It's called ECRI. It's used by the National Institute of Medicine, National Institute of Health. You know, it's internationally known. So we have them pull data as well. And so we have all the information available to look at. When we see that, we say, okay, are there randomized, double-blind, placebo-controlled trials that show that this is better than doing nothing or a placebo? If there's not, we probably don't need to cover that because it has no value. It's no better than a placebo tablet. A placebo is nothing. In fact, we have an issue with Medicare right now. There's a procedure that's done pretty frequently in the United States. This one procedure, Medicare alone paid $750 million to cover last year, and studies have shown that it has no value. It's no more effective than placebo. The American Academy of Orthopedic Surgery has recommended against its being used. We had a patient that requested it, God knows why, and we denied it, and Medicare overturned it and made us pay for it because it's a covered benefit under Medicare. We wrote them a letter saying, you know, studies have shown it's not effective. The specialty societies recommend against using it. We recommend that you not cover this. And they said, sorry, it's a covered benefit. So we had to pay for it. And that's waste. And waste is when you're using things that really have no value.
I guess the logical question is, why does Medicare cover it if Medicare itself found it out to be wasteful? Or you're saying Medicare just knows in aggregate what it's spending, $750 million on a procedure that it's covered.
That's right.
Why does Medicare not look at the evidence?
Well, they do sometimes. They don't always, and they don't make rapid decisions. They're not very nimble as an organization. And that's, I guess that's one of the advantages of community care. We are more nimble. As things come out where it's shown not to be effective, we can say we're not going to cover that anymore. Whether it's bone marrow transplant for breast cancer, which was shown to kill women, not really help them, or vertebroplasty, some of the new things that are creating some argument are what are called viscose supplements. They're little injections that you put in the knees that supposedly help knee arthritis. In the best studies, that has been shown to be no more effective than placebo. And then the latest edition of the American Academy of Orthopedic Surgery, again, recommends that they not be used. So, and yet we still get on a weekly basis requests for those types of injections, and they're $2,000 to $3,000 a knee. So it's, it's, again, waste. But we always look at the best available evidence in literature, and there's a lot of things that doctors do that have no evidence. More and more, there's good evidence about things, whether they work or not.
So even when you deny a service to an insured, a beneficiary, they do have the ability to appeal and say, oh, please have mercy, or here's an extenuating circumstance why you right. might want to cover it. And usually, I suppose, if the doctor goes to bat for them, that's helpful too.
Well, and doctors have been a very great value to us. We've denied some things because it's like when a doctor wants to use a drug off-label, it's not approved for a certain condition. An example of that was a drug called Remicade. It was used to treat arthritis. And we got a request from a gastroenterologist who said, I want to use this for my patient who has an inflammatory intestinal condition. Well, it wasn't FDA approved for that, and I had never seen anything on that. I said, do you have any literature that would support that? And so we talked to each other, and he sent in a couple of peer-reviewed articles from journals. And sure enough, they had been tested and found to be effective, so we approved it. So, again, we want all the care that helps, but we only want what helps. So if we're not covering something and literature shows that it's going to help, we want to cover that. On the other hand, if we had been covering something and new literature comes out that says, you know, that's not effective, we'll probably stop covering that.
I'm curious a little bit about your trajectory. You mentioned you practiced for 13 years and then, I guess, jumped in either at a staff level or became a medical director right away. How does one become a medical director of an insurance company?
I think you have to have brain damage. I think that's a prerequisite. I was practicing family practice for 13 years for Springer Clinic, and I had a very successful, very busy practice. I really enjoyed taking care of my patients, but I really felt like I could be doing more for a larger population of people. So I talked to the administrator that we had at Springer at the time, and he said, well, you should go for an MBA. So I went back, and I didn't get the executive one-year MBA. I went through the whole darn process.
Oh, my goodness.
This is where my paranoia comes in, because I have my medical degree is from OU, and my MBA is from OSU, so I have these inner voices that come out during bedlam time. But when I finished that, I really had no concept of what I wanted to do. I thought, well, maybe I'll be medical director for Springer Clinic. And that's when I got a call from a recruiter who they knew a doctor, and the doctor had said, call Dr. Summers. So I had never thought about being a medical director for a health plan before, and went through the process and ended up at community care.
And that's where you've been ever since?
That's where I've been ever since.
And so you've really seen some change. I mean, I guess it, like a lot of industries, the only constant is change. I mean, just with the Affordable Care Act being, you know, front and center in terms of what's going on in healthcare nowadays.
Well, I think the other thing that we've been able to do is really get rid of a lot of the red tape. We've done away with a huge amount of prior authorization, jumping through hoops to get things. I know most health plans to get certain drugs requires prior authorization.
Yeah, so that's just to explain, that's where a doctor may prescribe a medication for a patient, and then the pharmacy won't fill it without the health plan giving kind of a secondary
permission.
Yeah.
And for just about every drug that you take by mouth that you go down to the pharmacy to pick up, we don't require authorization for that. Now, there are some very expensive specialty drugs that are injection only. We still look at those, and it's because they're several thousand dollars a month that... In fact, we had one gentleman who was his drug bill was over $250,000 a month. We look at those very carefully to see, you know, is there anything that we can do, whether with case management, talking to the patient, talking to the doctor who's ordering it to lower costs. And in that patient, we couldn't. He cost us about $6 million in a year. But it can get pretty pricey.
Wow. It seems like community care might be incentivized to drive a bus up to Canada and try to get stuff up there.
No, I don't trust those drugs right now.
So how the Affordable Care Act, obviously in its infancy, How is community care projecting, I guess, that the Affordable Care Act will affect its bottom line? Or are you expecting a lot of growth, I guess, in the number of people you'll cover?
I think that on a day-to-day basis, everything changes. I mean, what we knew 2 weeks ago with regard to the Affordable Care Act is completely different to what we know now. We didn't know what pricing was going to be like, and pricing from state to state is very, very different. I have a brother-in-law who is in Illinois. He just re-upped, and he had a 71% increase in his premium. There are others.
71% increase?
And there are others who are not seeing a huge increase. I would say in most states, they're seeing a pretty significant, a well into the double-digit increase in healthcare premiums. Now, that's going to be counteracted by some subsidies that people will be getting back from the government. You know, 2-3 weeks ago, we thought that most premiums were going to be running in the $1,000 to $1,100 a month, and that subsidies would cover, you know, 80 to 90% of that. Well, we're turned out that we way overestimated what the premiums were going to be. They're going to be a lot lower than we thought they were going to be, and subsidies correspondingly are also going to be a lot lower. So a person making $45,000 a year might get a subsidy of $80 to $90 a month to help buy insurance. That's a lot less than the $1,000 that we thought he was going to be getting. The other thing is we don't know what role the other exchanges will play. There's the individual exchange, and there's the shop exchange, which is a separate exchange for small businesses to purchase insurance on. And prices, different companies have different prices on one versus the other. So it's very interesting, and we have no idea what the impact is going to be come January 1st when all these patients are supposed to go live. I mean, we might be overwhelmed. We might be underwhelmed. Who knows? It really depends on what the enrollment is. And right now, because we're not getting anything from the federal exchange, we have no idea what the enrollments are like.
I mean, Ray, it's got to be very tough to run a business not really knowing, you know, kind of how many customers you're going to have or, you know, that's what they're paying even.
Right. And they've made it very difficult for all parts of the industry. For example, if someone signs up and they pay their first couple of months of premium and all of a sudden they stop paying, the insurance company has to continue to pay their claims for another month, even though they haven't paid their premium. If they still don't pay their premium, at that point we can pend paying their providers for 2 months, and then after that they're off. But for those 2 months where, so now we're 3 months in, for those last 2 months, we basically send those claims back to the doctors and the hospitals saying, I'm sorry, they didn't pay their claims. You have to get it from the patient. Well, that's just awful. Physicians hate that. We just tell them, I'm sorry, that's the Accountable Care Act. That's the hand that we're dealt. So it's not ideal. It's not what we want to see, but that's how we have to do it.
And I guess the difference there is that previously, like a physician or a doctor's office would verify someone's insurance, whether they're paid up or not, and you could either keep them on or let them off the roll right away if they hadn't paid their premium.
Right.
So there's kind of this limbo period that's really made things cloudy and confusing.
Right.
Dr. Jack Summers is the medical director of Community Care Health Plan of Oklahoma. Well, that's our show for today. Studio Tulsa on Health is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. Views of our guests are their own and do not necessarily reflect those of KWGS or the University of Tulsa. If you've missed a recent show, you can listen from our archive anytime. Just click on Studio Tulsa under the program tab at our website, publicradiotulsa.org. I'm John Schumann, sitting in for Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.